Progressive Radio Network. Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, hi, my wonderful audience. I noticed today I don't have a musical background to my intro, but it's still the same show. It's me talking with the best folks around the world. We're listened to around the world by the leading people who are working on issues of psychiatric reform, people who have been injured in one way or another by psychiatry, professors, patients, families, the whole works. A week or two ago, I put up on Madden America a blog about violence and the latest information that I had on violence. And by chance, my wonderful Ginger came upon Katinka Blackford Newman. Katinka, are you there in Great Britain? Spain, you're in Spain right now.
I am. I'm in Spain on holiday with my two teenage children. So yes, I'm here, Peter.
So thank goodness the 01144 got through, because if I thought about it, I would have thought, wait, do I do a Spanish call numbers or not? But it got to you, thank goodness. And I guess I did it before too. But I always have anxiety when I dial abroad. I'm just old school. It just doesn't seem to me like it's going to work out like it always does. Well, before I get more into talking to Katina, who is the author of The Pill That Steals Lives, and it's on Amazon.com. You can order it there. I want to give you just a little background on some of my own experience very briefly. It is real that psychiatric drugs affect people to make them murderous and violent. It's not just methamphetamine and cocaine. It's not just the street drugs that do this. One of my cases that was settled was a man who, on two doses of Paxil, drowned his two children and himself in a bathtub. He had no psychiatric history. He'd been put on the medication because he talked to his family physician about cutting back on drinking. He was not an alcoholic, do a couple of drinks a night. And the doctor said, well, this will help you. Another case that I've been involved in was a father who, on antidepressants, murdered his two daughters, whom he loved, his little girls. Another case that I've been involved in was a mother who, on multiple psychiatric drugs, but at the time got an increase in her Zoloft, sertraline, another one of these antidepressants, got it over the weekend on the phone, increase in dose, had a psychotic episode, and shot her son, whom she loved, while he was sleeping, his children, then tried to beat her daughter to death. And all these cases I've been involved in one way or another. So this is real, and we've heard about many other cases. Susan Smith in this country back in 1994 was on psychiatric drugs, antidepressants, and she drowned her two kids driving her car into a lake or a river. And then Andrea Yates, who drowned all five of her children systematically, was on multiple psychiatric drugs. So these are very, very real issues. Now, Katinka Blackford Newman, is a filmmaker. And I'm going to let her tell you about some of her films later on, but most important is her book, The Pill That Steals Lives. And she's had an experience that is really quite incredible. And she's doing something that we've had a lot of trouble with. She's getting herself some publicity for these issues. And I'll let her tell you about that as well. She's actually, I know she's disappointed with the outcomes of how she's doing right now, but she's really getting the word out there in Great Britain, and it's spilling over into the U.S. So, Katinka, welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggenhauer.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here, Peter.
It's been a pleasure meeting you on the pre-show interview. So, just leap in and talk about what in the world happened to you.
Well, this is the way that it started for me, which is I was going through a divorce at the time. And to begin with, I coped really well when we first separated. But then I hit a significant blip about 8 months after we separated. And I was faced with having to sell the marital home. The children were 10 and 11, or 9, no, they were 9 and 10 at the time, and I felt this tremendous sense of guilt about taking them away from their neighborhood and so on. And so I had sleepless nights. I had some sleeping tablets that I was that I had for jet lag, and so I started taking them, and I hadn't realized, what I realize now is that I don't react well to medication at all. But anyway, I started taking those, and I just felt worse. Considerably worse. And so then I went to my GP and I said, look, you know, I just feel terrible, you know, I can't concentrate. The GP didn't prescribe antidepressants, but then I went to a private psychiatrist who did. So he gave me an antidepressant called in this country it's escitalopram, but I think you call it Lexapro. And so I took that as well as some mirtazapine. And so within hours, I started to react badly. I went into a sort of trance-like state. And I continued taking the tablets because I was told that's what I had to do. And 2 days later, I was acutely psychotic. Now, by that, I mean that I started hallucinating. I remember very clearly that it was as if I was looking down at myself and I saw myself being stabbed in the stomach. I became convinced that I'd killed the children. I have no recollection of this whatsoever, but I took a kitchen knife and I stabbed myself. And I was convinced that I was being filmed as a sort of like a Truman Show and that it was being broadcast to the nation. So I ended up in hospital after 2 days. I remember when I was interviewed, I told the doctors, I told the psychiatrist that there was a suicide pact with God, and that there were film cameras in the ceiling. So I was totally deluded. I did at that point, I realized that it was that pill that was making me ill. And I think, you know, at that point I was sort of, I was still very delusional, but I thought that I was being poisoned. But I was able to make some kind of connection. So I told them that I didn't want to take that, any more of the Lexapro. And so 2 days later, I was okay. I was very shocked, but I wasn't psychotic. But however, they just didn't believe me when I told them that it was the pill that had made me ill. And so they diagnosed me with psychotic depression. So I was then incarcerated in a private hospital in London. They wouldn't let me leave. And so there was a short amount of time when I was normal, but then they had insisted that I take antipsychotics and antidepressants. And as I was to discover later, that if you react badly to one of these medications, there's a strong likelihood that you will react badly to them all. So that began a slippery slope, which went on and off, or it went on for a year. Any questions?
Well, yeah, take a breath. This kind of story is typical of modern psychiatry. I'm seeing legal case after legal case, patient after patient, who gets worse on the psychiatric drugs. So that psychiatrists nowadays actually believe that most patients get worse, that they just happen to come see them at a time when they were getting worse by coincidence.
Yes.
They don't see themselves as making the people worse. I was just describing that this morning. I'm a little hoarse, by the way, because I was in a deposition this morning on behalf of a woman who got tardive dyskinesia from psychiatric drugs, a dreadful, dreadful movement disorder. And, you know, the doctors just made her worse and worse, and they kept giving her more and more. More and more, mostly of the same, on five different drugs.
Yeah.
This is just going on all over the world.
Yes, I know. Now I've heard so many stories like that. But I think what is shocking is that I was in a top hospital in London, and they didn't spot the fact that, you know, I had what I now know are very obvious signs of drug toxicity, one of them being akathisia. You know, I remember, I was unable to sit still. You know, I was unable to just, I remember I was forced to go to group therapy, and I just couldn't sit still, that nobody spotted, that this was just one of the side effects of the medication that they were giving me, and certainly nobody spotted the fact that I was acutely psychotic, that, it's really just not normal, for people to just, suddenly start, talking about suicide pacts with God and attacking themselves with knives when they've got no history of mental illness. Yet nobody, none of the doctors just said, hold on a second, what have you just taken, and let's just look at the package insert, and lo and behold, look, it says, psychosis, hallucinations are a side effect. Nobody did that.
In our medical training, mine in the 60s, we were taught that if somebody has an abrupt psychotic break and comes to the emergency room, and they don't have a history of this, think drugs.
Yeah.
And we didn't have so many drugs then that made people crazy. Mostly they were street drugs. Yeah. Now we've got all these drugs that make people crazy. And it's hard to know what in the world doctors are thinking, other than that the drugs are so toxic that if they began to look at all at what was going on, they'd have to quit practicing the way they practice, and that they can't do that for some reason.
No, I think that's I think that's absolutely right. But anyway, so just to continue with the story, I then they then gave me more pills, and I left the hospital. And I got, progressively more and more ill, and they started giving me then olanzapine. And I remember that was a sort of turning point for me. I think you call it Zyprexa there, don't you?
Yes.
And that was, and I remember then,
actually, we call it what you're calling it. You're using the generic names, and Zyprexa is a trade name. And I do think it might even be called Zyprexa or something close to that in Great Britain. So you're actually using the real chemical names of the drugs.
Yes.
But it is Zyprexa, yes. Go ahead.
So I was discharged from the hospital after 3 weeks, but I just wasn't normal. I had, had signs of drug toxicity still, the akathisia, and I had to go back every week, and they just kept on giving me more and more drugs. And then there was olanzapine was the next one, and that was a sort of turning point, I think. And at that point, I started binge eating, and I just lost the ability to function.
Would you repeat that? I just quite couldn't hear your last words.
Okay. I just lost the ability to function. I wasn't able at that point to just do simple things. I couldn't wash myself. I couldn't dress myself. If I went out of the house, I would get lost. I certainly couldn't look after my children, who were 9 and 10 at the time. So at that point, my ex-husband had to move back in. I just was, and there was the emotional blunting as well, so I wasn't able to feel love at all for the children. And, I was walking around in an old dressing gown, pretty much unable to leave the house. I'd, you know, previously been very dynamic. I'd been a sort of keep fit, not a fanatic, but, I'm like running and all of those things. And literally all I was doing was just sitting at home in an old dressing gown, unable to even, you know, just have a conversation or even watch television or read a book, you know, none of it. I just wasn't able to do any of those things. So it was horrifying for my children, who were 9 and 10 at the time. I mean, they literally just didn't, you know, they just completely lost their mother. So this is over a very, very short amount of time. So it was September 2012 when I had the initial psychotic reaction. And then I know that by November, December, I was literally unable to leave the house, unable to really finish a sentence. And I remember that Christmas of that year, I don't think I got dressed. I mean, I was just in the most terrible, terrible state. I had never drunk before, but I started drinking. I started smoking. I mean, chain smoking, 70 cigarettes a day or something. I mean, I was just a totally, totally different person. And I just wasn't able to converse or do anything. And in fact, it got so bad that actually it was so distressing for my children that I then moved out of the marital home. And so I ended up in a small two-bedroom flat away from them because it was just too awful for them to see me in that state. And I was unable to be a mother.
Katinka, what drugs are you on at that time? You're on Zyprexa. Anything else?
So I was on Zyprexa. I'm just trying to remember. I was definitely on Zyprexa. I was on probably Prozac by that time. I was also being given sleeping tablets. I can't remember the other. I was on four or five at the time. I can't remember the other two. It'll come to me. Very likely aripiprazole or risperidone. I can't remember which of those, but very likely one of those. But anyway, they kept on sort of just mixing them up, you know, and whenever I went back, you know, which was every week. It was kind of like, well, look, you know, you're just going to get, all we need to do is just, we need to just alter the dose a little bit. We need to give you a little bit more Prozac and a little bit less of that, and, you know, then you'll be okay. But, of course, it was the drugs that was making me ill. So I moved out of the marital home. I was in on my own in a sort of flat in an apartment, and I was so desperate. By about sort of 6 months after the initial incident, that I booked myself back to the private hospital, and then at that point they then said, oh, well, you know, maybe you're, you know, they said, well, maybe you're bipolar, and they then started giving me lithium as well. So I spent a further 6 weeks in the private hospital, and at the end of that, I was really just no better than I had been initially, and all that had happened was they just sort of put lithium into the mix. So that sort of, I sort of came out of there, and things were just getting progressively worse and worse and worse. And, you know, all of the things that I just loved doing, like being with the children or playing the piano, or, you know, it just didn't mean anything to me at all. I tried to play the piano, but I just couldn't be moved by the music. You know, it was kind of, it's hard to describe how awful it is being on those drugs, but it was almost like I was an observer looking at the life that I had had before. And also you end up feeling incredibly selfish because people just go, well, what is wrong? And you just go, well, nothing is wrong, but yet you just want to kill yourself because you can't. There's nothing that you enjoy at all. But, you know, you can't feel anything. You can't feel love for your children. You can't feel passion for music. You can't, you can't have a conversation. You know, your life becomes totally, totally meaningless. And, you know, I was seized with just a desire to end it all, really. The akathisia, the inability to sit still, and the sort of anxiety was just phenomenal, you know. So I would just be walking round and round the rooms of the flat, or I would just wander round and round the streets if I wasn't, you know, getting lost when I would go out. I was desperately trying to quell those feelings with alcohol or with cigarettes or just anything. It was just like anything to try and end the agony. You know, it got to the point where I was waking up at 2 a.m. I was going down to the supermarket. I was buying a bottle of vodka. I was buying all those herbal sleeping tablets, and I was taking all of that along with, all sort of 5 drugs that I was on, you know, antipsychotics and sleeping tablets and antidepressants. And, you know, I was just a dribbling wreck, and really just all I could think about was ending my life.
This story, many of my listeners know, but many others don't, I'm sure, is commonplace throughout the world today. Mainly the Western world, but growing more and more throughout the world as new markets are opened up by the drug companies. And these doctors are just operating like they are salespersons and distributors for the drug companies. There isn't a single scientific study that indicates that this kind of poly drug therapy helps anybody. I can tell you that being on Zyprexa alone in a, quote, therapeutic dose would make it impossible for me to see patients or to talk adequately on the radio show. It suppresses the, among other things, the dopaminergic neurotransmission to the frontal lobes of the brain, so it's producing a chemical lobotomy, and I don't mean that metaphorically. It's literally removing the frontal lobes functionally to a great extent from the rest of the brain. And it causes a Parkinsonism that makes you feel sluggish and immobile and inexpressive. And it's catastrophic. And yet, since the drugs were first started in 1952, really, in Europe, and then 54 in the U.S. and Britain, the doctors knew this. They knew what it was doing. They knew it was causing a terrible disease, these drugs that looked a lot like an encephalitis. They knew that. And I've written all about this in my books and brain disabling treatments and psychiatry, for example. It's a bizarre phenomena, and it's just so important that you're here to talk about it in this kind of detail. And everything about your story, Katinka, is just typical. The people on the drugs, they get what I call spellbound. They don't know it's the drugs. They can't believe it's the drugs. Their families can't believe it's the drugs. They think it's some strange mental illness. It's really quite dreadful.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, when I think of the despair that my family went through, you know, to see somebody who they just care deeply about suddenly, you know, talking about suicide and suddenly, you know, just unable to function, and the trust that they had in the doctors, it was covered by the insurance, but it's, you know, the hospital that I was at was, you know, cost £6,000. A week, you know, to be poisoned. It's quite something, isn't it?
It's quite bizarre.
That kind of money. It is quite bizarre. So, anyway, I mean, I was very, very lucky, you know, as you know, Vichy, you know, you've spoken to so many people that aren't as lucky as I am. And after a year, you know, by which time, I was verging on having, on brain damage, really. You know, I was dribbling, I was losing the powers of speech. And actually, if I look at the doctor's notes at the time, they were saying that I had the beginnings of tardive dyskinesia. You know, they described that. But unfortunately, they don't describe it to the drugs, quite bizarrely. So at the end of a year, again, I was so desperate that I tried to go back to the private hospital. And I spent 2 nights there on suicide watch. But then they said, look, you know, your private insurance has run out. And so they literally just sort of turfed me out. And, well, they didn't turf me out, but they said, look, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, that's it, kind of thing. And that was the luckiest thing for me. And it was actually the thing that saved my life. And so it was one of those occasions where I could say quite honestly that if I'd been richer, I probably would not be here to be telling you this story. Because I then ended up, they discharged me, and there was a moment, and I really, you know, I can say quite honestly that I, at that point, was so desperate that I was about to end my life. You know, I had planned it. I was going to jump under a train. And something told me, at that time I was being treated by, the local authority had given me like a sort of home treatment team who came in. And of course, the one thing that they did was to make sure that I was taking my medication. And I remember they sort of came in, and there was just something that made me turn to the woman who was there, and it was a Sunday, and I just said to her, and I think it was the thought of my two children, the thought of them losing me, that just made me turn to the home treatment worker, and I said, look, please will you take me to hospital? I have to go to hospital. And she took me to an NHS hospital. And it was that decision that really saved my life, because they took one look at me. I think I said the words that I knew would probably get me sectioned, which was, look, I think I said to them, I know I said to them, I want to kill myself. And so they sectioned me. And of course, immediately they sectioned me, I completely regretted my decision, because it was so different from the private hospital that I'd been to. And immediately they decided that they would take me off all of the drugs, because they saw that I was, you know, on so many. Their philosophy was that they were going to take me off the drugs and then see which ones worked, kind of thing. So they took me off all 5 drugs. And so literally within hours, I was going through agonizing cold turkey. I just really didn't know what was happening to me. And it was really utterly, utterly excruciating. All I wanted to do was to leave. I desperately, desperately tried to get myself out of there, you know, and I remember there was this guy wandering around the corridors who was sort of representing people, patients, and I said, look, you've got to get me out of here. And I managed to persuade him to try and get me a tribunal, you know, where I tried to argue that I shouldn't be there. But of course, by then, you know, it was sort of a few days into the sort of cold turkey. I was literally, when I was unable to finish a sentence, I was unable to dress myself, you know, so I was, everything was kind of inside out, and, you know, I was dribbling and shaking and drooling. So there was no way that they were going to let me leave. So it was a very, very, very difficult time. I didn't know what was happening to me. And then literally, it was as if by magic, 3 weeks later, it was as if I woke up and I was better.
It was very quick that happened?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was astonishing. It was really, it was a very, very strange thing. It was pretty much exactly 3 weeks. And I remember I was let out from the hospital one day, and it was my birthday. And I remember seeing the children, and they were the ones that spotted it. They just said I was allowed out, and we went shopping, and they just They just said to me, they said, "Mummy, you're better." And they noticed it. They just, you know, I was talking, I was laughing, I was already by then. I mean, it's, you know, a small thing, but I put on a huge amount of weight. I put on 3 stone. And already by then, I'd lost like, you know, 1.5 stone or whatever. And I just sort of looked normal. And, oh, I looked more like my usual self. And I was just, I was able to have a conversation. You know, we went shopping. We all went out for dinner. And the children had their mother back. And that was an amazing, it was an amazing day. And the hospital said that they still wanted to keep me in. Because they just wanted to kind of make sure that I was okay. So, but they sort of released the section, so it meant that I could come and go as I wanted. And so at that point, the hospital became a sort of place of, a place of safety. I didn't mind being there at all. So I would sort of just use it as a base. So I would just sort of leave. And, it was really the most extraordinary thing because it was like a rebirth. It was like suddenly... just discovering life again and getting my senses back. And so I started to I'll never forget just hearing a piece of music and being moved by it, or going for a run, going out and not getting lost. And, of course, just being able to love again and looking into my children's eyes and being able to feel love for them. So it was really, really the most extraordinary time to, you know, as I was recovering from the side effects of the drugs and becoming a human being again.
You were blessed. I mean, it's just a marvelous story of recovery, and you're very, very aware. I know that you're very fortunate that you had this remarkable recovery. It's so variable what happens to people. Some people don't recover from one drug, and some people recover from many. It's very unpredictable.
I know, and I think, you know, it was a year on the drugs, and you know, I'm pretty convinced that if it had have gone on any longer, then the damage would have been long term. You know, I was already, you know, I already had very slurred speech. I was already dribbling. I was, you know, I was in a real, real state. So I really. I just feel like I was just kind of on the edge, I think. So it was exactly a year, and then I suddenly just, you know, I kind of woke up and I was sort of shell-shocked. I was like, God, you know, what has happened in the last year? You know, I just looked back and I just didn't understand. It was like this sort of weird dream that I just woken up from, you know, that had started off with this kind of psychotic incident that I, you know, hadn't really completely understood that it was the drug, because nobody had really said that the drug could cause that. And then I'd gone into this sort of tunnel for a year and I just didn't get it. But my background was as a filmmaker and as an investigative journalist and was a researcher with the BBC. And so I was in this, you know, in this psychiatric hospital, and I had I had my laptop and I had a mobile phone, and so I sort of started doing a bit of research, and I contacted, I managed to track down one of the many experts in this area. And I contacted him, and I just said, "Look, is it possible? Is it possible that these drugs that I've been given, that they could have caused all of this? That they could have caused me to have become psychotic, to have attacked myself, to have then begun this, you know, year-long descent into hell, where I just wanted to kill myself?" And he said, "Well," he just said, "My God, you know," he said, "you're just incredibly lucky, you know, that just one drug can cause, you know, that courts around the world have ruled that that these drugs have caused people to kill themselves and others. And so that began a kind of long journey of not just recovery, but a bit a sort of investigative journey, which, first of all, it was actually just kind of, it was really me and my kids. So we sort of had to understand what had happened to me. We had, because the world was saying something very different. You know, there wasn't anybody else who was saying, aha, you know, this was the drugs. Everybody else thought I had some weird mystery condition that had just magically disappeared. You know, nobody could, you know, that they thought I had some kind of clinical depression or whatever, but I just knew that wasn't the case. I just knew it. But the three of us, we sort of went, we all read up about it. And your book, Peter, was one of the first books that we read, Medication Madness. And then there was another autobiography by an Australian lady called Rebecca Beddo, who's now become a very close friend of mine, and I've actually been to stay with her. She's been to stay with me, and I read this book, and it was like, my God, you know, exactly the same thing happened to her that happened to me, except she was diagnosed with, I think, postnatal depression, and exactly the same thing had happened. She was given one drug, she became suicidal, and then she was given more and more and more, and it was just by luck that she realized after 2 years that it was the drugs she believed that was causing her to be suicidal and self-harming. So it began with just sort of me and the children discovering these things, and then they sort of got on with their own lives, and I sort of just read up more and more about it. And I'm a filmmaker, I then of course wanted to make a film about it, and started filming a pilot, which was about sort of what had happened to me and the children. And then I'd never really thought of writing a book, but I knew somebody who's a literary agent, and so he persuaded me to write a book. And so which I did. And so the first part of the book was about what happened to me and the kids. And the second half, far more importantly, is a sort of journalistic investigation, in which I talk to experts, to people. I mean, I just realized how lucky I'd been, because I started talking to people all over the world to whom terrible, terrible things had happened. You know, like a guy who has also become a very close friend from Canada, his name is David Carmichael, and he took Paxil, and he believes that he became psychotic because of the drug, and he became absolutely convinced that he should, that he had to kill his 11-year-old son, and he did. And I mean, it's the most tragic story. And it was only after he came off the drug that he realized what he'd done. You know, I mean, he really thought that it was that he was acting in his that it was the best thing for his family. And he came off the drug, and he cried so much that he became dehydrated. I mean, you can imagine, you know, he woke up in prison and, discovered that this is what had happened. So I interviewed people like David, other people who had killed on the drugs from all over the world, and in which, you know, and where courts have ruled that they had killed because of the drugs. So the book was kind of the result of that, really. And I suppose I just realized how lucky I'd been, because I think, you know, the other thing that was astonishing, and, you know, you will know this, of course, Peter, because you've interviewed so many people who have become psychotic after taking these drugs. And the really fascinating thing is that they all seem to follow the same kind of pattern. People always seem to hallucinate about knives, guns, dying, killing themselves, killing other people. You know, it doesn't seem to vary from that. And there must be something about there must be something to do with what with the way that the brain works when it's flooded with serotonin, that it just flips that particular switch. And the other thing is that, you know, people often believe that they are, you know, that they're in a dream or that they're in a video game or whatever. And I remember that very clearly from my psychosis, that I suddenly thought, oh, well, we're just all in a dream. We're all going to wake up. So nothing really matters. And that's what is so utterly terrifying about the psychosis that these drugs can cause.
Absolutely. The only story in my book, Medication Madness, where I don't have medical records for these many, many stories, was a young girl who was 16 and feeling sad and got put on Prozac pretty much about the time it came out, maybe within a year of when it came out. And she got very, very depressed, and finally her mother got her to tell her what was going on, and she said, I want to stick a knife in you, and she just, you know, cried and cried. And the interesting thing was is they then went to the doctor, who immediately took her off the Prozac and said it must be the drug, because that's before Eli Lilly got its huge propaganda campaign going, so that none of the doctors believe it anymore. It's really bizarre how things go backward in that regard. But yes, it's particularly violent things. You know, a man who, actually, a woman who went and just stabbed her mother with a little penknife dozens of times is one of the early stories that came out. These just horrendously violent actions. And there's a scientific study of autopsies that out of Maryland that showed that suicides were, when they were on these drugs, were much more violent than the suicides off the drugs. So violence is a real, something gets triggered in there about violence. And then I'm sure the knives and the guns have to do with what's available culturally, but we get, something gets triggered in us about violence from these kinds of drugs. They're in a lot of people. And it's also on lower levels. People get irritable, they get angry, they take it out on store clerks, their family, on a much lower level as well. I just think these drugs are spreading an epidemic of hostility and irritability and anger and aggression, as well as these extreme cases that you experienced, that I, you know, that you've been talking to people about, and that I've written about.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right, and that's true. Of my experiences of speaking to people who have had much lower level experiences than me, they have, however, become. There are many cases where they've become seized with a sort of, you know, kind of minor desire for violence. You know, that I quite often just hear people go, you know, that I, you know, suddenly, you know, woke up and I sort of attacked my wife, for example, or, you know, just they just completely lose it. But also, I mean, I've also had, there are other cases in the book that I describe, and in fact, this was I've also been used as an expert witness in court cases in this country where antidepressants have been thought to be the cause. And, you know, in some cases, you know, there are people who have committed huge, really terrible acts of violence. You know, they've beaten people up, and they remember absolutely nothing about it at all. I mean, and including armed robberies as well. And they have literally woken up in a police cell, and they know nothing about it whatsoever. So, you know, these drugs clearly can cause you to go into a sort of almost dreamlike state.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. It's quite common for the people to have no memory of what they did. Sometimes people have a memory of it. I think the more delirious the individual is, the more there's been a generalized dysfunction of the brain caused, the less likely they are to recall. It's just, this occurs in every permutation. People who do it with like a clear obsession, people who do it in a delirious, hallucinated state. You can't muck about in the brain and know what's going to happen other than it's not going to be good. It's not going to be good.
Right. It's not going to be good. And, that's, one of the things I say in the book, which is that, when it goes wrong with antidepressants, it goes really, really wrong. Far worse than with street drugs. It seems to tip people into the most violent or suicidal acts. I would have found this really hard to believe unless it had happened to me, but I can honestly say that if I, with my metabolism or genes or whatever, that if I was given any of the antidepressants, literally within hours, I would be seized with a desire to harm myself or other people. There are a percentage of people that react so badly that it literally just affects them within hours. And you see, the other interesting thing is that there had been an incident for me many years ago, 20 years ago, and I had never, ever made the connection until recently. But I was given Paxil, Suroxat, because of a sort of work-related stress. And I had gone into serious toxicity, and I had never, ever, I'd never made a connection before. But it had had exactly the same. I wasn't psychotic, but I was completely, it really affected me very, very badly. But as you've pointed out, the drugs, they sort of hold you hostage, that you don't quite, you just don't understand it. And because your brain doesn't make sense of it, because it's such an extraordinary thing, your brain can't make sense of it. So you just park it and move on in your life. And it was only many, many years later, 20 years later, when I was writing the book, that I looked back. And I opened that box, the box that I'd sort of just, put aside of that whole incident, because I never, ever understood it. And I was able to look at it and just go, that's why that happened. That's what happened to me. So, I'm sure that there are lots of people going around who have had bad reactions to the drugs, and they don't realize it. It's just some totally weird thing that would have happened to them in their lives, and they just can't make sense of it, so they just sort of compartmentalize it and they just move on. If they're lucky enough to come off the drugs or whatever, but I'm sure that there must be lots of people who don't realize that they've had a very bad reaction to these drugs.
Yes, that young woman that I told you about, this is now decades later that her mother told me the story, and I got in touch with her through her mom and reassured her that it had been the drug when she was 16. And she was on the phone these decades later feeling some relief from the guilt and the shame of the feeling. She never did any. The feeling she had when she was a young teenage girl. It's just horrible what the drugs are doing. I want to make two points briefly before we finish up. We've got about 10 more minutes left at least. One is that people listening to such a graphic description are doing such a good job of describing all these drugs and what they do. Remember, folks, that you can't come off these cold turkey. As Katinka said, even in a hospital, she had a horrible experience going off cold turkey. And if you're not in a protected place, you become very dangerous to yourself and other people. So you can't come off these drugs cold turkey. And I write about that in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. And the other point I want to make, I had Irving Kirsch on the show for an hour on June 8th. Yeah. You can go and look up Kirsch on look up that date. And he has done the definitive studies. And the point is the drugs don't work either. I mean, some people think they work, but when you do an actual study of all of the clinical trials done for the FDA, not just the two they cherry pick to get approval, but the 4, 5, 6, or 8 that are actually done, the drugs don't work. So here we have a drug, a group of drugs, the antidepressants, particularly the newer ones, the SSRIs, as well as Effexor and Wellbutrin and some others that are stimulating. And you have a drug that there's no doubt that it causes tons of adverse reactions. All you got to do is open the label for the drugs, the full prescribing information, Google full prescribing information, read it for any of these drugs. And there's a nightmare of things that are officially acknowledged to be associated with the drug. And then you find out, well, how did the drug get approved? Well, it was studied for 4, 5, or 6 weeks. Then you find out that if you actually look at all of the efficacy studies instead of just the two they cherry-pick, the drugs don't work. You literally have a neurotoxin with no redeeming features making drug companies wealthy and destroying lives. It's a tragedy beyond conception.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And in fact, that all of that is I talk about in the book and his studies as well, which are really, really useful. So, my book is certainly not just about the small percentage of people that have severe adverse reactions. It's also looking at the hidden trials and, you know, the fact that they're no more effective than a placebo. And also, I think, you know, very importantly to mention is that, I have come across a lot of people now, some in the book and some since, who have contacted me since the book has gone out. But there are people who have started out well on these pills. And it's, but sometime down the line, they have become, very ill from them. Even after they've stopped taking them, they have long-term neurological damage. Things like tinnitus, sort of electric shock, sort of sensations going through their bodies. And there are a number of people that I know of who actually, simply cannot function and have had to now go, they've tried to get off the drugs, but have had to go back on them and have long-term damage from them. The drugs are only tested for 6 to 8 weeks. By the drug industry themselves, and that means that we are in fact the long-term studies. So even for the people that start out well on them, it's very alarming that there are now people who are saying, "Hold on a sec, I started out well, but now I can't get off them, or when I do get off them." I have all of these symptoms, and even having come off them, these symptoms continue. And I'm sure, Peter, you've got lots of patients who are in that situation.
Well, absolutely. And it's creeping into the textbooks. There's a new, over the last decade or so, apathy syndrome from the SSRIs. Of course, studies are showing that the vast majority of people who take these drugs have sexual dysfunctions, love dysfunctions, feeling dysfunctions, and very often they don't fully recover afterward. And also going back on the drug, as I'm sure you know, Katinka, doesn't always work by any means.
No.
So
no.
It's people get into terrible straits.
It is terrible. I mean, I don't know what to do when these people contact me and they say, "What do I do?" I can't. They've got akathisia where they can't sit still, and they've come off the drug, so they have to go back on it. And they're going to every expert that there is, and nobody can do anything at all. And they've had to give up their work. They've had to, it's destroying their lives completely. And somehow this story just is not getting out into the mainstream media.
It's not getting out. No. Let me
it's
say
just
a more
getting
positive
out. I mean,
note,
you know what is
Katinka? Let me say before we finish, a more positive note, which is that I work with people who learn to not think of themselves as just their bodies, who develop their spirituality, develop their sense of effectiveness again, and they're able over time to even go on with a good life, and sometimes some number of my clients better lives than they had before they ever got involved with psychiatry because they had problems. And to even live with situations where there is an akathisia that ordinarily would just be totally demoralizing, but with work, the brain and themselves, their will, they learn to grow and to have good lives. But it's a lot of work, and there are very few people willing to do that work with other people. And they do meditation, they do acupuncture, they do exercise, they do Pilates, whatever it is that gets them in touch with their bodies and makes them feel healthier. So I don't want to leave on this totally totally bleak note. There is hope for a lot of people, but the tragedy of imposing this on human beings is inexcusable. It's such a shame on the whole medical profession.
The reason I wrote the book is I just said, look, people need to know the facts and then they can make up their own minds. You know, if people need to know that these drugs are only, you know, they're only tested by the drug industry for a short amount of time, you know, nobody knows what the long-term effects are. You know, those are things that people need to know. You know, the fact that you can, you know, have a acute reaction, all of those things, you know, the public deserves to know that before they take something, surely.
Yeah, and I think the public is more and more going to stop taking the drugs, but the drug industry, which has the billions of dollars and has the complete support of psychiatry, organized psychiatry worldwide, will keep pushing and pushing, and as more people stop, more people will get on. What I'm seeing is that the public is very much more enlightened, but the vigor of the publicizing and the lying about the drugs grows, so more and more people continue to get hooked. I hope someday the public will just say, no, we're not going anymore. We're not going to psychiatrists. Yeah. We're not going to expose ourselves to this. This is not the way to go. They're doing things they can't even justify with their own corrupt science. I mean, that's the tragic irony here.
And I think also the problem is that there's just this whole feeling that depression and anxiety is a sign of mental illness. You know, depression and anxiety is just part of life. You know, that is not a sign that you're mentally ill. That's a sign that you're a human being. You know,
that is a really good place to be finishing. Yes, it's a sign of being a human being. We suffer, we have ups and downs, and there's all of life is the solution, not drugs. Folks, you've been listening to Katinka Blackford Newman. The book is The Pill that Steals Lives. The Pill that Steals Lives. Thank you, Katinka.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. All right.